It is a beautiful evening here in North Dorset. I'm standing at Windy Corner on a strip of concrete. Behind me is a gargantuan corrugated iron building, the last hangar of RAF Tarrant Rushton. It was from here, 8 years ago, on the 5th of June 1944, that six Hawser gliders took off under tow of Halifax bombers. On board, 181 men of D Company, 2nd Battalion, the Ox and Bucks Light Infantry, 20 sappers of 249 Field Company, Royal Engineers, and 12 pilots of the Glider Pilot Regiment, under command of Major John Howard. Their mission, to capture the bridges over the Caen Canal. This is the story of the greatest invasion in history.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
Supreme Allied Commander General Dwight D. Eisenhower's message to the Allied Expeditionary Force on the eve of D-Day, 5th of June, 1944. I'm Harry Bucknell, and in this special programme, Voices of D-Day, the Army Benevolent Fund marks the 80th anniversary of Operation Overlord, the largest amphibious invasion in the history of warfare, marking the start of the campaign in Northwest Europe, which led to victory over Nazi Germany in May 1945. Journalist and military historian Sir Max Hastings outlines the challenges the Allies faced, the hurdles that had to be overcome, and the significance of D-Day itself.
The one great advantage the Germans had in June 1944, when it was obvious to everybody that they looked doomed to lose the war, but they were already on the battlefield in France, whereas the Allies had to devote enormous planning and effort and thought to the effort of actually getting there. You think of all the millions of tons of steel, the enormous amount of kit that had to be prepared for the landing, starting with the Mulberry harbours and so on. The amphibious landings are one of the most difficult arts in warfare. And the Allies knew that while all the odds, their overwhelming superiority of aircraft, ships, tanks, suggested that D-Day must succeed, the consequences of failure were horrific. And first of all, it would almost certainly be a year before they could mount another invasion. Secondly, there'd be a crisis of confidence in the Allied leadership. Eisenhower might well be obliged to resign as Supreme Commander. The position of Winston Churchill in Britain and of President Roosevelt in America, they would totter on their thrones if D-Day failed. And everybody knew, Alan Brooke, the head of the British Army, a gloomy fellow, but also a brilliant one. And Alan Brooke wrote repeatedly in his diary before D-Day, he said how terrified he was about the consequences. He said, at its best, D-Day will fall short of the expectations of many people who do not understand its difficulties. At its worst, it could be the supreme disaster of the war. So all the odds said that with the Germans reeling from their huge defeats in Russia, with this overwhelming Allied superiority of kit, that they were going to succeed, that all the time, every commander haunted by the consequences of failure. So you can say, if you want to be a cynic, that the Allies were going to win the war anyway, that the Russians were going to get to Berlin, whatever happened in Normandy. But on the other hand, it was still the decisive event of the Western War. But it was, and it was also a moment of rehabilitation for the British people after so many humiliations and defeats since 1940. Here they were last, heading back to the continent of Europe, returning to the battlefield on which they left with, yes, near ignominy in June 1940 at Dunkirk. So it's impossible to overstate the importance of D-Day, and I think it's absolutely right to celebrate and commemorate it on this 80th anniversary.
Former Chief of the Defence Staff, General Lord Richards of Hurst Monceau, explains the preparation required for the invasion of Normandy.
Here we are, sat on at Sicy Castle, overlooking the Solent, which on the night of the 5th of June would have been absolutely teeming with all manner of shipping from east to west, out in the sky, thick with aircraft. But in order to get to that point of D-Day on the 6th of June 1944, what did take place in terms of overhauling our military outlook?
Well, after Dunkirk, what was actually a very good little army, the British Expeditionary Force, had to be rebuilt and made much bigger. Most of the regular officers and soldiers effectively became trainers, certainly the middle-ranking officers and NCOs, turning a citizen force into a professional army. And that's where people like Montgomery came into their own. And I think the scale of effort, the breadth of deployment, don't forget we were shortly afterwards engaged in the Far East. We were very heavily involved in 1941, but particularly again in 1942 in the Western Desert. And then Italy, starting with Sicily, where a lot of lessons were learned about amphibious landings, and then into Italy. And around the time we got going in Italy, half the army was taken away to focus on Normandy. So the British Army and the armed forces generally was hugely stretched, and without any shadow of a doubt, without the Americans being involved, there's no way we would have done it. And I would just like, well, painting a strategic picture, just think what the Russians were doing at the same time, because without them then Normandy would never have occurred, because one of the preconditions for success in Normandy was that the Germans would be pressed by the Soviet Union, the Soviet forces, and pressing them back, and that was achieved. The other things that were necessary was winning the Battle of the Atlantic, because they had to sustain a huge American army. 1 million, 1.5 million soldiers had to be got across, and they largely had to be trained and then victualled and accommodated. They needed logistics sorting out, so the idea of the Mulberry Harbours came about, and then they needed air superiority. And not until those four things were achieved could the Allies really look themselves in the face and say, okay, we can now do it. And that was achieved towards the end of 43, early 44.
There was a lot of speculation on both sides as to where the invasion would come from. What was the deception plan that we put in place to keep the Germans guessing about where the point of it was going to be, from Calais to the south and beyond?
Well, it was central to success. There are all sorts of aspects to it. Operation Fortitude was probably the best known element. There was a north and a south. Fortitude North was actually, I think, focused on Norway. Fortitude South was based in the southeast of Britain, of England. But there were other aspects to the
mincemeat. Mincemeat was part of it, wasn't it? When they dropped the airmen into the sea.
That was a relatively small part. There was a spy, a double agent called Garbo, who was central to this effort. And he actually, right before the D-Day landings themselves, confidently told his German masters, they thinking that he was, you know, worked for them. He said, the present operation, through a large-scale assault, though a large-scale assault, is diversionary in character. Its object is to establish a strong beachhead to draw the maximum number of our reserves into the area of the assault and retain them there so as to leave another area exposed where the enemy could then attack with some prospect of success. Now, the key character in many ways to this working was General Patton, who had had a rather shaky few months after hitting a soldier in Sicily the year before. But in the eyes of the Germans, he was without doubt the Allies' most feared general and most competent general. So the Allies, I think slightly unwittingly, played up to German presupposition by putting Patton in charge of this army based in Kent and East Sussex and so on.
With dummy tanks, the whole field, the whole thing. Plastic, I mean, tanks and
the
block.
Scale was amazing. And you know, they could get over there and they had some spies. But that Garbo transmission played into this. And, of course, it was playing into the Germans' predilection to believe that, of course, Patton would be the main effort when it came. Yeah. But the reason it was so important is that the main German counter-attack force was actually based in the Pas-de-Calais, opposite this imaginary army. And this was the 15th Army. And they were fixed by the deception operation into not counterattacking in Normandy. If they had, and this was a very powerful army group, if they had, then there's a pretty good possibility that Normandy would not have succeeded. That is how important the deception operation was to the outcome.
The plan for Overlord was simple. With General Eisenhower in overall command, the Allied land forces of the United States, Britain and Canada, under the leadership of General Montgomery, with General Omar Bradley's American troops on the right, landing at Utah and Omaha, while General Dempsey's Second Army on the left would land at Gold, Juneau and Sword. Operations Albany, Boston, Tonga and Mallard were the codenames for a parachute and glider-borne force of over 18,000 men, comprising the US 82nd, 101st, and British and Canadian 6th Airborne Divisions that would protect Allied flanks and take key bridges to ensure against counterattack by enemy armour. Reconnaissance was vital to the success of such a major undertaking. The late Major General Logan Scott Bowden, CBE, DSO, MC and BAR, explains the very hazardous scouting missions that he and Sergeant Bruce Ogden Smith, both Royal Engineers, undertook as part of the close observation pilotage parties that were inserted on the beaches by X-class midget submarines of the Royal Navy in the early months of 1944.
We sailed from Portsmouth. In fact, we were towed out to halfway across the channel by an armed trawler, which couldn't then come any further. Then we came under our own steam overnight on the surface, in this midget submarine, which needs a bit of description. It's not very big. The inside of the hull is only 5'11", and it was absolutely full of equipment. It was driven by, on the surface, by a London bus diesel engine, but of course it had electric motor and batteries to enable it to go under the water, and it was full of pumps and pipes and periscope and a snorkel and echo sounder and all kinds of other equipment. So it was absolutely chock-a-block. The team consisted of Commander Nigel Wilmot, who was the boss of the COP organization, and the skipper of the X-craft, the midget submarine, was Lieutenant Ken Hudspeth of the Royal Australian Navy, and his engineer officer was Bruce Enza from Northern Ireland, and then there was myself. I was a major then, and Sergeant Bruce Ogden-Smith, and we'd been fully trained as crew members of the X-craft in 2 months training up at the Loch Striven Head, where the main training place was for small submersible craft. Well, we came across, and as we approached here, having crossed over the minefields, the German minefields of the sea, and we came in there, and to our considerable surprise, there was a small fleet of fishing boats with their nets out in this part of the water there. And as we closed in on them, we had to figure out how to get through and not get entangled in the nets. And Nigel decided to go directly underneath one of the boats. And as we approached it, he handed the periscope over to me to see if I could get an identification of the German guard on the boat. And I had a good look at him. It was a wonderful periscope, and I can remember exactly what he looked like. He was leaning back in the bows. He was smoking one of those big German curved cherry wood pipes. He had his rifle slung over his shoulder, his collar up, his great coat and a forage cap on, and there was no way in getting any identification of what unit he might belong to. Anyway, I passed the periscope back to Nigel, and we dived underneath, and that guy would have been very surprised to have seen and known that a commander, a major, and two other naval officers and a sergeant were about 15 feet underneath him at a particular point in time. The day after we got back, I was making out my reports and received a telephone call from Rear Admiral Creasy, who was Chief of Staff to Admiral Ramsay, the overall Naval Commander-in-Chief. I knew Admiral Creasy, as I'd been briefed by him to some extent, and he told me to report to his office at 2 o'clock on the Sunday, the following day, as he had a few questions to ask. I reported to him in London at Norfolk House, which is Supreme Command headquarters, and he walked me into a large map room where all the maps were covered with no light from outside, and all the maps were covered with curtains, and there were a dozen chairs at one end facing a map, and then in came another five admirals and five generals, including General Omar Bradley and Major General Peter L. Smith, and they sat down, and I was told to, completely unbriefed, told to give an account of our reconnaissance. Actually, the map was no good, because it was far too small scale, and they all had to come down to the other end of the room to a better map. And I got on with it. And then they fired questions at me for about another 25 minutes. General Bradley was the most persistent questioner. And
when the briefing drew to a close, Scott Bowden said to Bradley of Omaha, "Sir, I hope you don't mind me saying it, but this speech is a very formidable proposition indeed, and there are bound to be tremendous casualties." The US General, putting his hand on the Major's shoulder, replied, "I know, my boy, I know." As troops converged, much of southern Britain became a massive training ground. Whole tracts of the coast were restricted, and villages like Tynham in Dorset and Slapton in Devon were requisitioned to rehearse landings. But with the tide of war turning in the Allies' favour, a second front to attack the enemy further wasn't welcome to many. On the 23rd of May 1944, 2 weeks before D-Day, my grandfather, Lieutenant General Jerry Bucknell, Commander 30 Corps, recorded in his diary, "Army Commander telephoned re serious absent figures, over 900 in 50 div. Experienced and valiant veterans of the fierce fighting in North Africa and Italy, they were the lead element for the capture of Arromanches to secure Gold Beach, commanded by the much respected Major General Douglas Graham. Behind them would follow Major General Bobby Erskine's 7th Armoured Division, the legendary Desert Rats, to take over for the subsequent Operation Perch, the drive for the key town of Caen. No less experienced, they too were inevitably wary of what was to come. Max Hastings.
I remember a D-Day veteran saying to me, "You fight a bloody sight better when you don't know where it hurts." And the boys who've been in the desert, like the 7th Armoured Division, they knew where it hurt. And I always remember Mike Carver telling me, who commanded an armoured regiment in the desert as well. And he told me how, before D-Day, that some of his NCOs had come to see him, and a little delegation had come into his office and said, "It's the wives, sir. They're saying, why do we have to go again when there's all these buggers in England who've done nothing for 4 years?" And that was a fair question. And a point I remember getting a letter after my book Overlord was published from Anthony Kershaw, who'd become a Tory MP, but in 1944 was brigade major of an armoured brigade. And he described to me vividly a mutiny in the barracks, who had daubed their barracks with slogans, "No second front now," that they didn't want to do it. And I don't blame them at all. Whereas on the other hand, a lot of the blokes who've been in England for 4 years, bored out of their skulls, training. And we should never forget that all through the Desert War, the Italian campaign, Far East campaign, more than half the total British army have been training and training and training in England, bored out of its mind. So the whole thing of battle hardened, one of the things it tends to make you is very sensibly cautious about coming round a corner where you might meet a German tank on the other side, and you know that if you fire at the German tank, the shell is quite likely to bounce off, whereas if it fires at you, it's going to be a Ronson job. And so the boys who've been in the desert in Italy, they knew this. So I would never suggest that some of the ones who were not so keen to go were in any way cowardly or whatever. It was jolly tough on them having to do it all again.
"You've bitten off much more than you can chew. Come on, hold your hand out."
The British 6th Airborne Division, 8,500 men, commanded by Major General Richard Windy Gale, consisted of two parachute brigades under Brigadiers James Speedy Hill and Nigel Poet. Aside from capturing Bonneville or Pegasus Bridge on the Caen Canal and Ranville Bridge over the River Orne, their task was also to destroy the Merville Battery, which posed a considerable threat to the landings, and secure the exposed left flank of Lieutenant General John Crocker's I Corps, while getting established on Juno and Saw beaches. Former Chief of the General Staff, General Sir Michael Jackson, an officer in the Parachute Regiment.
"Normandy D-Day was really the first use of airborne forces on this scale.
I think it's fair to say that one of the key components of that was the coup de main attack, which was led by the Oxford and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry, and D Company, led by Major John Howard.
John Howard, yes.
Who captured the legendary Pegasus Bridge.
He did an extraordinary feat of airmanship. A very senior Royal Air Force Air Marshal said it was the finest feat of airmanship in the whole of the Second World War, and they were soldiers.
Jane Barkway Harney, Vice Chair for Glider Pilot Regiment Society and daughter of Staff Sergeant Jeff Barkway, Distinguished Flying Medal, one of three pilots, all of whom managed to land their Horsa gliders to within yards of Pegasus Bridge. A remarkable achievement, later feted by Air Chief Marshal Sir Trafford Lee Mallory.
But let's talk about the glider pilots and the work they did, because they flew two gliders that we had, the Horsa glider, which was a rather sort of elegant-looking aircraft, really, and then the Howell car, which was a great big box of a thing, which you could fit a tank into. And so they fly with their tug, and this tug is the tug, the DC-3 or the Dakota or the Halifax bomber is putting a great weight, and they can talk to the tug through the intercom, which is running down the cable which connects the glider to the tug. And then come the moment that the RAF have got their navigation right, they cast off. Well, your dad then begins to earn his pay. How did he do it?
They always used to say that communication cable didn't always work. So it often sort of came adrift during the tow. So they would have sort of a torch with Morse code, if as plan B, because it was always the glider pilots that released the tow rope. If the tug pilot released it, the rope would flip back and probably smash through the cockpit of the glider. So it was always the glider pilots that actually released it. But they had to rely on the RAF having, as you say, got their navigation right. And yes, then they were on their own. So Dad would literally just fly the plane, and his navigator or second pilot would work out the coordinates and the time on each coordinate. Sadly, for all six gliders on the night of 5th of June for the Coupe de Man operation, most of the infantry in the back had smuggled in extra ammunition, extra rations, extra anything they can. Even a wooden collapsible boat went in the back of Dad's without being weighed. So they actually were way overweight on the night. But Peter Boyle, Dad's co-pilot, he had like a little clipboard. He had a stopwatch and a little torch on the end of his finger. And he literally called out the coordinates and then started the stopwatch. And Dad would fly on that compass setting for however long until Peter said change to whatever. They would change to that compass setting. And if you can sort of imagine, Dad used to liken it to a walking stick. So they came in at the end of the walking stick and then came down to the handle, did that turn, came back on themselves. And that's when they then came in to land at Pegasus Bridge. But they could see some of the water. They could see, they had a little area cut out in the bottom of the glider and a piece of Perspex put in so that they could see the ground, so that they could try and pick out some highlights of what they would recognise from the film they had seen. So it was really...
Lovely, simple. When you consider that everyone else has got tracking devices and radar and all this, and all they've got to do is Perspex. It's remarkable, really. But you say that your father's aircraft was hopelessly overweight, but it didn't do them any harm, because I think your father was piloting the third glider to come in. They landed within 47 yards of the objective. That was pretty spot on.
They came in so silently that the Germans didn't realise they were landing. If they had dropped paratroopers, they would have been spread over a wide area, whereas the troops in the back of a glider landed in that little pinpoint spot, and then they could jump out. Luckily, the Germans were starting to erect what they called Rommel's asparagus, which was very tall poles with incendiary devices on the top. They had actually dug the holes, but not actually put the poles in. So luckily, but the pilots just said, if they're there, it will help slow us down. They'll just...
and it was the case that if you were a glider pilot, that come the day when you had to do your job for real, most of them would break their legs, wouldn't they, in the process? It's quite common.
It was very common. Even the infantry in the back of the plane, they as they came into land and they shouted brace, the lads in the back actually linked arms and then lifted their legs up, because obviously the glider was only made of plywood. Yeah. And with a little bit of Hessian covering, you know, there's not a lot between you and the ground. And often the bottom of the glider would smash up. So they would lift their legs to avoid damage to their legs. But obviously the pilots didn't really have that luxury. No. And the glider came in at such a steep angle. It's, yes, a lot of them. I mean, thankfully, you could say thankfully or not, I don't know. Dad and Peter were thrown through the cockpit on landing and landed in the marshy water, which Dad had a quote as saying he came round from being knocked unconscious to think, well, this isn't going to get me very far. I'd better get out of this.
What were his recollections of the 2nd Battalion, Docks and Buckslide Infantry, and how they were? They were a splendid organisation.
They were. I think they had enormous respect for each other. They got on incredibly well. They all stayed friends for life. But he also remembers them as singing some rather... questionable songs across the channel as they were going over that night, and Dad remembers having to ask them to perhaps be quiet because the Germans would hear them coming with these rather bawdry songs being sung from the back of this very silent glider. After they'd landed, whether it's true or not, but there was always a story that the Gondres were down in their basement with their children, and they heard all this crash landing, and they had gone down there to hide, not knowing whether it was friends or foes. And that Georges Gondret then said, it's got to be the English, because listen to the swearing. And that would have been the Ox and Bucks lads. So they definitely had a bit of a reputation. But unfortunately, in Dad's glider, because although he was the third glider, he landed in the middle. So the first glider had already landed. Oliver Boland's second glider, Dad was so overweight, he'd almost sort of come in on top of Oliver. And Oliver had just about spotted him and tried to sort of swerve a bit to avoid him. So Dad came over the top of Oliver and landed in the middle spot, which was even more incredible, really, when you consider how it's about half the size of a football pitch, the area the three of them landed in. So to land with that sort of accuracy is, well, to me, it's just mind blowing. But Dad and the other pilots would say they practiced it on the Salisbury Plain about 40 odd times. If they didn't get it right on the night, they weren't worth their pilot's wings. So they had to do it on the night. But yeah, Dad did sadly have one of the chaps in the back got caught as his glider broke up on landing. He got caught under the skids and sadly then drowned in the pond. But he was really the only casualty of the landings, apart from various concussions and bruises and stuff. So incredible, really, when you think what they did, and they were the only casualties. Just amazing.
I think we need to put this into context. Your father was thrown through the cockpit, basically crashed through the windscreen, and he then nearly drowned in the marshy waters surrounding it. Unlike the American glider pilots, the British glider pilots then were considered to become infantry. So your father was then part of D Company, the Ox and Bucks Light Infantry, and their assault on Manoogle Bridge. What was his recollections of the fight?
Dad's recollections were slightly blurred. He did suffer concussion as he went through the cockpit. And his job of him and Peter immediately on landing was to start unloading the glider with the guns and everything that was in the back. And so that was what they were tasked with. And that's what they were doing when Dad felt a pain in his wrist and realised he'd been shot. And he thinks... His memory, he always used to say, I'm not sure now what I remember from the night, what I remember from being told, and what I remember from reading in a book, and that sort of things. But he's fairly sure he and Peter were unloading the glider. He was challenged, and he couldn't remember the password. And they'd actually changed the password just before they took off from the UK. And he thinks he gave the previous password instead of the new one. And so was shot. But so it was most likely friendly fire, but they only caught him in the wrist. But Peter came back from wherever he'd dropped the last load from and found Dad calling out to him and Dad's wrist pretty much hanging off by a thread. So a few of them dragged Dad into a ditch just to get him out the way of the fighting and the bullets and sort of relative safety. And then I think... From that, Dad had pretty much passed out. He vaguely remembers being in Café Gondret, the little cafe on the side of the canal. And then he can remember a few soldiers looking at him, not giving him much chance of survival. He had lost a huge amount of blood and he'd also got gangrene. Oh. So that was why his arm was then amputated, because they weren't able to save it.
The first aircraft that is going to lead the very front in the early hours of tomorrow morning is turning onto the end of the tarmac to make its takeoff. A graceful machine, and its wingtip light shining red and green over the heads of the dark, small figures of people on the aerodrome watching it take off. Taking off from here loaded with parachutists, and taking with it perhaps the hopes and the fears and the prayers of millions of people in this country who sleep tonight not knowing that this mighty operation is taking place. There she goes now, the first aircraft leading the attack on Europe.
Richard Dimbleby describing the lead aircraft taking off as Operation Mallard gets underway. Sir Max Hastings.
We talked very briefly about Merville Battery. Of course, this was the first major air assault we'd ever been involved in, one of the last in that sense. What's your take on the efficiency of the operation? Because by the time Nine Power actually rallied round of the whole battalion, they were in 130 minutes to take the battery.
I think what they did, I'm just writing about it at the moment. What I've said is, in the wars of Wellington, there were these so-called forlorn hopes, that if you had to storm an impossible position and you'd send in a group of guys who knew that they were overwhelmingly likely to get killed, but if they survived, that they became heroes. And the most famous episode of the Forlorn Hope was the storming of Badajoz in Spain in 1812, and most of them were killed. And the irony was that while the Forlorn Hope was suffering these ghastly casualties in the attack on one side, that actually on the other side, the British were getting in at the back, so to speak. But I've described the attack on the Merville Battery as pretty much a forlorn hope. And how Otway, the colonel in command, Terence Otway, must have felt when he found, well, we know how he felt livid with the Royal Air Force for having dropped so many people in the wrong place. But he only had a quarter of his battalion with which to launch this attack. He had to watch three gliders, which were supposed to land full of one of his companies inside the battery position, actually swoop overhead and land somewhere else. he felt pretty angry, but there was another thing which not many people have noticed. And that was, he was missing the Royal Engineers Party, who were supposed to be carrying charges to blow up the guns with. And I don't know whether he stopped to think about it before they launched the attack. But of course, it might have occurred to him eventually that, all right, so supposing by a miracle we get into the battery and we do actually capture these guns, what are we going to do about destroying them? Because you can't fire Sten guns at them or whatever. Anyway, they launched the attack. A lot of people are killed and wounded. That they get to the guns. But there were a lot of ironies which have only emerged in recent years from modern research. First of all, quite a lot of the Germans locked themselves in deep in the bunkers, and they never... And then when they got to the guns, instead of the 150mm coastal guns that they were expecting to find, and intelligence had told them to expect, these were... World War I Czech howitzers, 100mm stuff. And although they got together small charges and put them in the breaches and so on, and they made some bangs, but actually they weren't effective in disabling the gun. And then Otway looked at his watch and he lost all his radio sets, and he had no means of telling anybody that the attack had succeeded. And he knew that the cruiser Arethusa was due to start shelling the battery position anyway. So he felt he had to withdraw. And they'd done something amazing and very brave, and a lot of people had died to achieve it. And anyway, they somehow staggered out with their wounded and so on. But the Germans, survivors, when they emerged from their bunkers and they looked around, they couldn't understand what the British had come for when they hadn't destroyed the guns. And also they thought, well, even if they couldn't destroy them, why don't they just stake the sights? Because any artilleryman knows that if you take the sights off the guns, that they're useless. But nobody had done that either. So the German reoccupied the battery. And the next day, June the 7th, the commandos, three commando, launched another murderous attack. And they too got the guns, but they too had no means at all of getting in there and blowing them up. So the guns stayed there till the end. But the important thing that Nine Para found out before the landings was that there was nothing in the Merville battery that really the amphibious landing force had to be seriously frightened of. But it's the story of so many great, great feats of arms in history that it turns out to have been... not worth what everybody hoped it was. But the fact remains, one's admiration for those men who did that. It was a terrific feat of arms, and nothing about the size of the guns or anything else changes that fact. But it's a hell of a story.
General the Lord Richards.
I'm right in thinking while the invasion was taking place, we had aircraft flying over the channel that were dropping sort of chaff almost, wasn't it, to fool the German radar that our aircraft were going in other directions at the same time.
All that was going on, bombing in different places, and of course it had been preceded by people like Garbo's message, but a whole run of misplaced plans and rumour mongering about where the real attack would take place, including a belief playing on their understanding of Churchill's distaste for a Normandy direct approach, which is favoured by the Americans, and the Germans knew that.
Run, run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run, run. Bang, 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 bang goes the farmer's gun. Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run, run.
Normandy veteran, 100-year-old Rear Admiral John Roberts, CB, at the time of D-Day, was a submarine warfare officer on board the destroyer HMS Serapis.
We came back from a Russian convoy. I think it was the second one, second or third. And we were then put through about 2 weeks of bombarding practice, little islands and things, or rocks, and Scarpa Flow. We did bombarding practice and also rehearsing with a is it an FPO?
Forward Observation Officer. So you're doing naval gunfire support.
That sort of thing. That's right. And then at the beginning of June, we went down to Portsmouth, and there were, I think, 40 destroyers in the Solent. Well, I'd never seen more than about 15 destroyers at one time. The Solent was absolutely crammed. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning on the 5th of June, when the captain was allowed to open a brown envelope with the details of what we were going to do. But up till then, we didn't know when or where.
Of course, the weather was appalling on the night of the 5th of June. And Eisenhower had to give the order to cancel or delay by one day. That was that sense of we're going, are we going, are we not going? Was there a sense of that? Because this machine was already, it was rolling.
And it was a huge machine. The number of people involved, it was amazing how it all worked like clockwork. When we sailed at about 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening, it was June, so it was light in the evening, all the houses, as you go out of Portsmouth Harbour, had wrens billeted in them. And they all came out on their balconies in their 90s to wave to us. I've never forgotten that.
That must have done morale no end of good. So it's about a four-hour steam from Portsmouth to the Normandy landing zone. You were leading the minesweeping convoys to make sure there were no mines. You were protecting the minesweepers while they cleared the lanes through, so then the landing craft and everything could take place in that. When you arrived on station, as it were, on the Normandy beaches, what was your sense of the night and the attack as it was going in, both above and aside you?
Well, I was pleased, really. I was pleased that I was involved in something that was working, because at our beach, not all that much was happening. Mm. I think it was at the American end where they suffered a lot. I think it's only about 500 people were killed on our beach, which is not very many when you think of what they went through.
Mm. You had a Norwegian destroyer, the Svenna, who was hit and sunk in one go. What was the when you saw that hammering? That must have been quite.
Well, we felt it first of all. Mm. The explosion of the torpedo going off. You know, the sound travels through the water. So we knew that something had happened, and then just about 1,000 yards on our port side was the Svenna, and she sort of broke in half and went up in a V and then went down. Mm. And I've always said and thought at the time that it was unfortunate and sad in a way that 100 or I think about 75 sailors died from Norway.
Mm.
You know, if it was from England to France, that's not bad.
Yeah.
But from Norway to France,
yeah.
And to be the first ones killed was a bit hard.
Graham Fryatt recalls the hazardous landing craft transfer suffered by his father, Les Fryatt, then serving with the Royal Artillery.
Well, I think the first thing was that they weren't really aware of what was going on. He said, you know, they were driving down to Tilbury and people were cheering them on. And he said, you know, something must be big must be happening. But I think that's the usual thing. They didn't seem to be aware themselves what was happening. Then, of course, he went on to the boat to sail to Normandy. And the favourite story, and I think it's a story he's already told, is that when he went to disembark from the boat onto the landing craft, he's scaling down the rope ladder, put one foot on the landing craft, and the landing craft and the boat separated. And all of a sudden, his friends said, "Fryatt, jump, jump." Well, no way I'm going to jump. But fortunately, the landing craft came back and he's able to get on.
Cross-decking from ship to landing craft took place some 7 to 12 miles offshore, resulting in an hour or so approach to the beaches. The vessels, long, flat-bottomed, were cumbersome, difficult to handle, and rocked and swayed violently in the heavy sea.
Your beach was Sword Beach. When you saw the landing craft going past you to the beaches, what was your thoughts at that time?
I thought, thank God I'm not in one of them. The good thing for them point of view, it was still a little bit rough. And soldiers get seasick quite easily. So I think a lot of them were almost wanting to get ashore so that they weren't seasick anymore. But we waved and cheered them on. But then by the middle of the morning, we began to get one or two casualties who were brought off because obviously we had a sick bay and we had a doctor on board, including our FBO, who got, well, he was badly wounded and he died on board.
Mm-hmm. The bombardment, 11 destroyers, and then battleships like Warspite, Ramillies, Roberts, Mauritius, Arethusa, the Frobisher, bring down naval fire. The bombardment must have been quite deafening, I imagine.
Well, the last hour before HR, the noise was amazing. The noise and the flashing of lights, because, as you say, there were all those ships, and if I'm boasting, the naval gunnery is a bit heavier than Royal Artillery. You know, 15-inch shells make quite a bang.
Yes.
Graham Fryatt recalls his dad, Les Fryatt's, memory of HMS Belfast broadside.
That was only 20. There's all these 20-year-olds all together, so you can imagine all the banter that was going on between them.
He spoke about HMS Belfast, who was in action on D-Day when she was giving a broadside. And I think he said it made him jump, didn't he?
That's right, yes. I think so. Like he did say, he said, "Oh, goodness me," but I can't believe it. I can't believe that those are used.
Rear Admiral John Roberts.
There were rocket ships, rocket tank. They got to within a mile of the beach itself. And then 25 rockets would go off. Rather like you see Russians firing.
Yes, Katushkas.
Go up into the cloud and come down literally on the beach.
Mm.
And then there were about 200 or 300 flying fortresses which were flying along the beach, not across it. They flew along it, dropping bombs all the time. So the beach area was, I couldn't understand how anybody was still alive there.
And overhead you've got this air armada. Going out to sea, going out heavy, delivering paratroops and bombardment all the way through.
That's the Serapis in the foreground. That's at 5 o'clock on the 6th of June, and that's 500 gliders being towed to go inland and land inland. This is separate, of course, from Pegasus Bridge.
This is Operation Mallard.
Was it?
which is the subsequent operation.
Yes.
Where once General Richard Gale and 6th Airborne Division headquarters had landed, Operation Mallard was then to consolidate that position with an enormous air armada.
The sky got quite dark. Yeah. It was almost like an eclipse.
Incredible image. Rabbit, rabbit,
military historian Sir Max Hastings.
But on June the 6th, by most standards, the weather was bloody awful. And those guys in the landing craft, heading for a hostile shore across 2 or 3 miles in flat-bottom landing craft, was hardly a man afloat who wasn't horribly, horribly seasick. And one thing I think the generals had completely underestimated was just how groggy a lot of the infantry were going to be when they got off those landing craft. And a lot has been written, some of it by me, about the fact that the Allies were quite sluggish at moving inshore. But in a way, what's miraculous is that they managed to get moving so quickly after that those weather conditions offshore. So you can point to all sorts of things that went wrong on the big day, but what's astounding is how much went right. All the other specialised British kit, which the Americans rejected, flail tanks for clearing minefields, fascine tanks for filling ditches, bridging tanks, all this specialised stuff, the so-called funnies, actually worked brilliantly well. Mm. And I think we have grounds for enormous pride in the feat of planning and logistics that led to D-Day, even before you talk about the courage of those who went ashore. And a point that I've often made, which I think is important, when my first book about Normandy, Overlord, was published in 1984, a lot of veterans were still alive, and they were outraged by the fact that I said the German army was man for man more professional than the British army. And the only thing that saved me from being lynched was the fact that some senior officers who'd been there, like Dwayne Bramall, who'd served with the rifle brigade in Normandy and so on, they were kind enough to come to my rescue by saying publicly, well, Max Hastings was right. We knew that the Germans were professionally more skillful. But there's a very important secondary bit of this. Even though the British Army did not show itself as professional, the British war machine was brilliantly conducted. And I've suggested the British war machine, which included all the things like Ultra and Bletchley Park decrypting operation, and the way that the Joint Intelligence Committee operated, and all the bits of the war machine under Churchill, that was brilliant. It was far better than any other nation's war machine, better than the German, better than the Russian, better than the American. And it was the sort of saving grace. We mobilized women more effectively than any other nation, including the Russians. So I think we should say, yes, it is perhaps true that the British Army was professionally not as skillful as the German Army, but the British war machine was fantastic. And it was the British war machine that deserves a lot of the credit for the planning for what was Operation Neptune when it was a landing from the sea and then became Operation Overlord with the Battle of Northwest Europe.
Fighting, especially on the heavily defended American beach at Omaha, was desperate. At Arromanches, Gold, the story was slightly easier. My grandfather, General Jerry Bucknell, on board HMS Beagle at HR, noted that by 0900, leading units of 50 Div were ashore with little interference. Heavy seas prevented his landing before 22:30. In his diary he wrote, "Joined HQ 50 Div and tied up with Douglas Graham. Things are satisfactory, but we are about 12 hours behind. The Boche is fighting. We are on the outskirts of Bayeux and just over the Searle River. Keeping up with the battalion on my right, one US Div are only 1,000 yards beyond the beaches. On the left, 3rd Canadian Division are up but untidy. Still numerous pockets of Boche. Weather improving. Message from General Monty. He is delighted." Max Hastings.
I think one of the things that became more difficult from 1944 onwards was that everybody with half a brain knew that the Allies were going to win the war.
Yeah.
And so it became ever more attractive a proposition to try and be alive, to see the moment. And I'm always moved, I never stop being moved by a lot of young men who did incredibly brave things in Normandy and afterwards, despite the fact that, you know, this sense of they weren't going to be here. And one of the most vivid conversations I ever had, I was interviewing Robin Hastings, no relation of mine, who commanded a battalion. And one of his sergeant majors, Stan Hollis, won a VC for three or four suicidally brave actions on and after D-Day. And Hollis, extraordinary man. I mean, Hastings would say to him, now, Sergeant Major, you see that German pillbox over there? We've got to take that out if we're going to move. And Hollis would say, right, sir. He'd pick up a couple of grenades and a Sten gun. And then when he ran out of grenades, he threw his shaving brush and charged straight at the German position. Now, most people who did things like that died. And Hollis, amazingly, lived to keep a pub in Yorkshire after the war. But Hastings said two things to me that stuck in my mind. He said, one, he said, you know, he said, in the course of the whole war, I think that Stan Hollis was the only man I met who felt that winning it was his personal responsibility. He said, everybody else I met, I came across, it was some bloody awful job to be done. They'd hoped some other poor bugger could be found to do it. And the other thing he said, very sadly, he said it was easier to get Stan Hollis a VC than it was to get him a decent job after the war.
By midnight on the 6th of June, 1944, soldiers from regiments such as the Green Howards, the Dorsets, the 4th 7th Royal Dragoon Guards, the East Yorkshires and the Sherwood Rangers had fought like lions, establishing a foothold on mainland Europe. On Gull Beach alone, 24,970 men had landed, while a further 150,000 were ashore across the five beaches. The cost of victory, however, was high. Over 4,400 men lost their lives in the course of the assault. Max Hastings.
Does it rank with Agincourt, Waterloo and Trafalgar?
I think that D-Day does deserve to rank with the other great battles of history, whether it's Agincourt or Waterloo or Trafalgar or any of those battles. And in the end, it was something that we got right, importantly right. And our forebears were absolutely right to take pride in their terrific achievement. D-Day was a moment when we had absolutely no doubt that our forefathers were fighting on the right side. Many times since, in the wars that have followed, there have been many causes to doubt whether we were the good guys. I don't think anybody doubted that our forebears were the good guys on June the 6th, 1944, and they richly deserved their triumph.
Jane Barkway-Harney.
I just think they were all incredible, you know, and I think every regiment, every man, every woman of every regiment, without everyone working together, it would never have happened. You know, the glider pilot regiment, I obviously think, are the best regiment ever, but they couldn't have done it without the RAF towing them. They couldn't have done it without the ground crew. They couldn't have done it without the women who were on the ground preparing their food, looking after them on the ground. You know, everyone played a part, and that teamwork, all those cogs working together, made it successful. I think we've got a lot to learn from it. Sadly, with, you know, the wars still going on today, it shows that we perhaps haven't learned the lessons of World War II. But as working in a school, working with young children, it's one of my passions, my sort of life goals, to make sure that the children understand what happened, that actually the freedom they've got today to be able to be little brats, to be able to say what they want, to be able to do what they want, wear what they want, all the freedom that they've got today is down to that generation and what they did. And although I'm hoping it never happens again, I think we've got to appreciate, we've got to understand where that freedom came from and never take it for granted. Because with wars like Ukraine and Russia now, we can't take it for granted.
The Greatest Generation were all heroes, and we at the Army Benevolent Fund salute each and every one of them. 8 years on, ABF continues to safeguard our soldiers, veterans and their immediate families, so they can live a life of independence and dignity for the service they have given for our freedom and liberty. for soldiers, for life. It is the debt we owe them yesterday, today, and tomorrow. With my thanks to Rear Admiral John Roberts, General Lord Richards, General Sir Michael Jackson, Sir Max Hastings, Brigadier Robert Scott Bowden, Jane Barkway Harness, Graham Fryatt, Adam Holloway MP, Diane Stradling and Helen McMahon for their contribution and help in the making of this programme. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to learn more about the work of the Army Benevolent Fund, the national charity of the British Army, please visit armybenevolentfund.org. Programme editors were Kath Mills and Natasha Theobald. Adolf, written by Annette Mills, was performed by Billy Cotton and his band. Run Rabbit Run, written by Noel Gay and Ralph Butler, was sung by Flanagan and Allen. I Vow to See My Country was performed by the band of the Coldstream Guards under the musical direction of Lieutenant Colonel Graham Jones. With studio editing by Michael Siliano, this has been a Gamekeeper production for the Army Benevolent Fund.